of the seven assets U.S. insurance companies with a property and casualty business, Liberty Mutual is the only one with a policy that restricts underwriting for coal projects, ShareAction pointed out. By contrast, 54% of non-U.S. insurers impose restrictions on underwriting for coal projects. However, ShareAction said that none of the 70 companies receiving scrutiny has placed limits on underwriting for gas and oil, despite a 2018 warning from UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that building new fossil fuel projects and keeping global warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius are incompatible. The analysis of the global insurance industry comes on the heels of a bombshell report published last week by the International Energy Agency, in which the relatively conservative institution made clear that remaining fossil fuels must stay in the ground if the world is to avert the most catastrophic effects of the climate emergency. Regarding biodiversity loss, the vast majority of assessed insurers have not yet developed an approach to managing nature-related risks to their portfolios and show little understanding of how their investment and underwriting activities are driving or may be affected by the biodiversity crisis, the report noted. Moreover, nearly three-quarters of assessed insurance companies, that is about 73%, do not have an investment policy covering human and labor rights, ShareAction found. Only 13% of assessed insurers have made a commitment not to invest in companies that are knowingly in breach of human and labor rights, showing that the industry is willing to turn a blind eye to direct and deliberate corporate human rights violations, the authors wrote. North American insurers are the worst offenders. Not a single one of the 24 insurers from the U.S. or Canada has a policy. Underscoring the need for the insurance industry to evolve, the report noted that only one of the seven assets U.S. insurers with a property and casualty business has carried out climate scenario analysis to identify long-term risks to their portfolios compared with 46% of non-U.S. peers. ShareAction called that particularly alarming in the context of recent wildfires in the U.S., which in California in 2020 alone caused insured losses of an estimated $8 billion.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September 19th, 2018. At the time the Prophet dies, this government was a stable establishment that could be a model for all humans throughout history. Had that establishment continued in the same direction, the history would undoubtedly change. That is what is supposed to happen centuries later, at the time of Imam Mahdi's reappearance in the current situation, would have happened at that time. A world replete with justice, purity, truthfulness, and kindness is a world of the era of Imam Mahdi, alayhi salam. It is the time when the authentic life of humanity begins. The authentic life of mankind in this world begins after the reappearance of Imam of the time, may God hasten his return, and humanity will achieve great development then.
Ana mazlum Hussain, Ana mazlum
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
Thus, had the persistence of Prophet Muhammad's establishment been made possible, and had it been formed during the early years, the history of mankind would have changed. The final destiny of human life would have unfolded much earlier. However, this was not realized for various reasons. The main feature of Prophet Muhammad's establishment was that instead of relying on oppression, it relied on justice. Instead of relying on paganism and division of human thought, it relied on monotheism and focused on worshipping God. Instead of ignorance, it relied on knowledge and wisdom. Instead of promoting revengeful behavior among the people, it relied on kindness, compassion, the establishment of friendly relations and tolerance, a neat government both in apparent aspects and innermost aspects. One who grows under such a government becomes pious, chaste, knowledgeable, insightful, active, enthusiastic, dynamic, and moves in the path toward perfection. 50 years after the passing away of the Prophet, everything changed.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
As a measure of both the nation's creaking infrastructure and the severity of the drought gripping California, there is the $5 shower. That's how much Ian Roth, the owner of Seagull Inn, a bed and breakfast in a tourist town 3 hours north of San Francisco, California, spends on water every time a guest washes for 5 minutes under the shower nozzle. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist and San Francisco bureau chief Thomas Fuller. The piece is titled Small Towns Grow Desperate for Water in California. As a measure of both the nation's creaking infrastructure and the severity of the drought gripping California, there is the $5 shower. That's how much Ian Roth, the owner of Seagull Inn, a bed and breakfast in a tourist town just 3 hours north of San Francisco, spends on water every time a guest washes for 5 minutes under the shower nozzle. Water is so scarce in Mendocino, an Instagram-ready collection of pastel Victorian homes on the edge of the Pacific Ocean, that restaurants have closed their restrooms to guests, pointing them instead to portable toilets on the sidewalk. And the fire department has asked sheriff deputies to keep an eye on the hydrants in response to a report of water theft. "We've grown up in this world thinking that water is given," said Julian Lopez, the owner of Café Beaujolais, a restaurant packed with out-of-town diners in what is the height of the tourist season. "There's that fear in the back of all our minds that there is going to be a time when we don't have water at all, and only the people with money would be able to afford the right to water." Mendocino's water shortage is an extreme example of what some far-flung towns in California are experiencing right now, as the state steeps deeper into the second year of a massive drought. Scores of century-old hand-dug wells in the town have run dry, forcing residents, inns and restaurants to fill storage tanks with water tucked from faraway towns at the cost of anywhere from 20 to 45 cents a gallon. Utilities in California, by contrast, typically charge their customers less than a penny per gallon of tap water. This past week, residents of Mendocino watched as the Senate passed this $1 trillion infrastructure package, wondering whether some of those funds might reach them. Dianne Feinstein, the senior senator from California, has pointed out that the package specifically targets drought mitigation projects such as water shortage, water recycling, and water desalination. But it can't come soon enough for many living in small towns in northern parts of California. The drought is revealing for California that perhaps even more than rainfall, it is money and infrastructure that dictate who has sufficient water during the state's increasingly frequent dry spells. The drought and the effects of climate change more generally have drawn a bold line under the weaknesses of smaller communities with fewer resources. 600 miles to the south of Mendocino, in a much more arid part of the state, Lake Peris Reservoir, a large artificial lake that provides drinking water to San Bernardino and Riverside, is nearly full. Lake Skinner, Lake Matthews, and Diamond Valley Lake in the dry hills southeast of Los Angeles City are all around 80% full. These robust reservoirs, part of the powerful Metropolitan Water District of Southern California, illustrate that the haves and have-nots of water in California today are determined by financial muscle, but also by decades of planning. Southern California's cities have built up huge reserves through a century of building aqueducts and reservoirs and storing water in underground aquifers during wetter years. The Metropolitan Water District, which is the largest supplier of drinking water in the country, has 13 times as much storage capacity as it did in 1990. And Southern Californians are using much less water than they did in the past. The average consumer uses 40% less water than three decades ago. The net result is that, despite its more arid conditions, the South is well prepared for this drought. The smaller northern cities of California, like Mendocino, Fort Bragg, and Ukiah, are in wetter climates and accustomed to relying on a plentiful supply of water from a single source. But water specialists say that climate change and the weeks of hot, dry weather in the north mean that these smaller towns are going to have to start following the example of the south and build water systems that store water drawn from multiple sources. This is one of the things you often see during drought, says Jay Lund, an expert on California's water system at the University of California, Davis. The bigger cities that have a lot of wealth and are very well organized, have a lot of long-term planning, are pretty well prepared for the drought. Across Northern California, reservoirs are at critical levels. For the first time since it came online more than five decades ago, a power-generating station at the Oroville Dam stopped producing electricity last week because the reservoir, currently at just 24% of capacity, has dipped too low. The massive Shasta Lake Reservoir at the top of the agricultural Sacramento Valley is now at 30% of its capacity. In Santa Rosa, an hour north of San Francisco, the city has put in place a mandatory 20% reduction in water use and sends inspectors through neighborhoods to check for excessive water use. Restaurants have been ordered to serve their customers water only on request. In Mendocino, the immediate concern is being able to find enough water to last until the winter rains. Ryan Rose, the manager of the town's aquifer, spends his days in desperate bouts of rainstorming. The town could string 50 miles of fire hoses through the redwood forest to the city of Ukiah for an emergency supply of water. Black Hawk firefighting helicopters could drop water into the reservoir at Fort Bragg, 16 miles up the coast. The paradox for Mendocino, which is flanked by vast redwood forests, is that on many days the town is shrouded in moisture. The fog can get so thick that residents towel off their dogs after morning walks. Silicon Valley companies have approached Mr. Rose about installing machines that convert the fog into drinking water. In the long term, residents of Mendocino say the town needs to consider desalination or building pipeline networks that connect with other towns on the sparsely populated coastline, projects that would cost millions of dollars. We definitely need the help of the county, the state, and the federal government, Mr. Rose said. It's not as if Mendocino did not see the crisis coming. Wells have been running dry for years, but not on this scale and not this early in the year. Ed O'Brien, a retired fire chief in Mendocino, was part of a group of residents who two decades ago scoured the region for alternative sources of water and ran into numerous roadblocks. Mendocino has a number of water sources around it, but local rivers become brackish in the summer and many are protected as salmon habitats. Sue Gibson, a retired schoolteacher who has lived in Mendocino for the past three decades, has given up taking baths in her cherished clawfoot bathtub and is resigned to doing the dishes by hand. When you go to a dinner party, you take a bottle of wine and a bottle of water, Ms. Gibson said. It's very common for people to ask whether you flush or not. With the help of friends, Ms. Gibson says, she will muddle along. But it's not how I was going to spend my golden years.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. After just about 20 years since the invasion and occupation of Afghanistan by the United States, the Taliban have overthrown the Washington-supported Afghan government. President Ashraf Ghani has left the country, and the United States and some other Western nations are scrambling to get their nationals out of Afghanistan. We will look at Afghanistan on the spotlight, the goals of the Americans for originally going into Afghanistan and what was really accomplished and what may lie ahead for Afghanistan under the Taliban. I'd like to start off this conversation in Kabul itself with Amin Alami. Amin, thanks so much for being with us. Well, we'll start off with please filling us in on the latest situation on the ground there.
Well, Marzia, Afghanistan has entered a new chapter, and the Taliban are currently in full control of the Afghan capital, Kabul. Just a few minutes ago, a Taliban member appeared on the Afghan national TV. He assured the residents of Kabul of their safety and asked them to resume their daily life. In the meantime, the roads and the streets inside the capital, Kabul, are empty, and the Taliban has also asked the residents of capital to honor a night curfew just tonight. In the meantime, the people of the residents of Kabul seems to be worried about what has happened, because it happened just during 6 or 7 hours on Sunday. They are worried, they are concerned, because they are facing a change of power, a change of regime now here. They are facing the Taliban, despite the Taliban has already emphasized that no one will be harmed by their members. Even they assured the governmental employees and the members of Afghanistan's security and defense forces and other employees of the Afghan government to be safe. The Taliban are also stressing that the foreign embassies, international aid agencies, NGOs, and international and media workers are allowed to work here. But it will be very important to realize that the Afghan president was named as the former Afghan president by Abdullah Abdullah. He said that the former Afghan president has left Afghanistan and its people behind irresponsibly. In the meantime, another prominent political leader and former Afghan president, Hamid Karzai, also shared a video message showing him and three of his children who emphasized that I'm in Afghanistan, I'm in Kabul, and I'll stay along with my family alongside the people of Afghanistan here. But another important fact is that the residents of Kabul are even seeking shelter abroad, because they think that at least there would be no enough atmosphere or place to work for most of the residents here who were working with international agencies or many other local or regional agencies who cannot work under the Taliban.
You talked about that last part. I just want to touch on that, because you said a lot of Afghans, those who can, are trying to seek to go outside of the country. What's the overall situation right now at the airport? We're hearing conflicting reports.
As I mentioned, a Taliban member who appeared on the Afghan national TV also said that the entire Kabul capital, Kabul, is under the control of the Afghan government. He said that ARG and Shashtarag, was known as a diplomatic area, are also under the control of the Taliban. But it is not, we are not being informed Either the Kabul International Airport is completely under the control of Taliban or not, because we are hearing and we are seeing that some helicopters are flying over Kabul, over the diplomatic area of Kabul.
Okay, stay with us. Thank you so much for that update. I'd like to welcome our other guests to the program, political analyst Elijah McNair out of Brussels. And the co-founder of American Peace Movement Code Bank, Madia Benjamin, out of Washington, D.C. Thank you both for being with us on the Spotlight. Well, let's start it off in Brussels. And Elijah, very fast-moving, fluid situations taking place in Afghanistan. Now, all American forces were supposed to have been withdrawn by August the 31st, even before the official end of Washington, Afghanistan. Now, the Taliban have taken control of the country. This happened so quickly. Your assessment of all of this, when Afghan forces had been trained by the U.S. and its Western allies for 20 years, and they have the best equipment, what happened in your perspective?
Thank you for having me. Actually, I think it was a very big surprise to the Americans that is a strong indication of the failure of the intelligence services. We heard President Joe Biden saying just a few hours ago, 24 hours ago, that it is no way Taliban will come into the city, that the U.S. forces trained 300,000 Afghan troops, and they are fully equipped with a strong air force. And we saw all this collapsing within hours, and then by the time we hear the first news, then something else is happening. And then we hear that Taliban is not going into the city, and then we see the Taliban inside the presidential palace. I think this move of Taliban surprised everybody in the international community. And NATO in Brussels was really shocked. The people I spoke to, they did not expect this fast move of Taliban and the collapse of the Afghan army and the institution and the and how the president of Afghanistan escaped and ran away with his family and his aide and his vice outside this the country and to seek refuge somewhere else, that he abandoned his country. So all that, we understand that the Americans are really unreliable wherever they go into any country. They've trained the Iraqi army for 11 years, and the Iraqi army collapsed in 2 days. And they've trained the Afghan army in for 20 years, 300,000, and this army collapsed in 1 week. This is really a record to what the Americans are capable of, and a clear indication of their failure and how they really failed to earn hearts and minds of the population, and how their training is consisting in how to use of weapons, but they don't give any motivation to the people of the region to feel how they need to defend their country or how to look after their country. They want people to be loyal to the Americans, and now the Americans have left, and then what? So this is what happened to Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. The army is really completely scattered with no orders to be given and nowhere to go. They don't know what to do, so they allowed Taliban to go into the capital and control it.
Well, what about that, Madia? Did Washington, because Washington itself could not establish security on the ground in Afghanistan, did it anticipate that the Afghan military could do it? And obviously, they have assessed the Afghan military in these 2 decades. If they were going to withdraw, which was definitely needed, most people in the region would say that. Why was it done so haphazardly?
I think they had terrible intelligence. The fact that Biden just recently said that the Afghan army was strong, the fact that the spokesperson for the Pentagon, John Kirby, just 2 days ago said that there was no imminent threat to Kabul is really a black eye on 20 years of black eyes that the U.S. has been getting. To do this withdrawal in such a terrible fashion where they took the troops out and then announced that they were bringing troops back in. And now they're announcing even more troops going back in to evacuate the Americans who are there. Just makes absolutely no sense and shows how miserable the U.S. military, the U.S. intelligence, the U.S. generals, the entire operation has been for 20 years. Unfortunately, the victims are the Afghan people who are very worried right now about what the future will bring, how the Taliban will govern. They're worried about will the Taliban really stick to their assurances that there will not be revenge killings, who knows. But it is a tragic departure from a war that should never have happened in the first place.
Well, Elijah, I mean, there's been a little resistance, as you pointed out, by Afghan forces, the Taliban, and we have seen it's been very quickly that the Taliban have taken over the whole country now. But what does that say in general to you? Some say that it's a sign of frustration on the part of the people and the military of the status quo, the former Afghan government, and not willing to risk their lives anymore to actually support this government. How do you see it, Elijah?
Well, when we have President Biden saying there are only 70,000 Taliban and 70,000 managed to occupy a country that is twice the size of the United Kingdom, that is a lot of telling us. The population, most of the population, either fed up of the American presence and the pro-American ruling, or they are in support of Taliban, or both. When we see the Taliban walking into the provinces, being able to occupy seven provinces in a few days, this is really incredible. They're walking in without fight. They walk into the capital, Kabul, without fighting. It means that the population want the departure of the Americans and want the departure of the government that is pro-American. Now, we have to wait and see if Taliban is coming with a new face or a new style. We hear in the first hours of their presence at the presidential palace that they want everybody to be involved in the government. They don't try to provoke diplomatic mission. So maybe Taliban that we knew 20 years ago or in 1996 when they declared the first emirate is different from the Taliban that is today. And I think their behavior with the population and the killing that President Obama and Bush before him using the drone by indiscriminating killing the population while trying to hunt down Al-Qaeda and other Taliban operatives, that helped the Taliban to earn the support of the population and to enter so many cities in such a record time.
What about that, Madia? I mean, that's actually fascinating what Elijah said, that the U.S. went in saying one thing, but the reality on the ground actually made people support the Taliban more than they had before because of the U.S. and its Western allies' crimes that was basically continuous in their country.
That's right. There are so many Afghan civilians that have been killed by the U.S. and the NATO forces. And then on top of that, while we in the United States have been constantly hearing about the corruption of the Afghan government, I think inside Afghanistan, you would see that the most corrupt element has been the U.S., whether it's the U.S. military or other aspects of the U.S. government that have been injecting billions and billions of dollars into the country to make individuals wealthy, both in the United States, the contractors, as well as individuals inside of Afghanistan. It's interesting that the Taliban have been showing images of Dostum's palace. It reminds you of Saddam Hussein's palace when the U.S. went in, but showing the enrichment of those who are in control now is something I think that most Afghans understood, that this war was big business and that it was the puppet government of the United States and the West that were the ones that were really enriching themselves, and it made people inside Afghanistan very angry. And we hope that we can make that clear to the American public so that there is some kind of accountability in the United States for the literally trillions of dollars that has been sent on this colossal failure.
Well, Elijah, why didn't the U.S. initiate nation building during this 20 years that they were there? Or was the goal always just to create another dependent client state? Not one which could be independent, and obviously not one which could hold its own.
Absolutely. What the Americans are trying in the Middle East and West Asia, we see what they've done in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen, because the war in Yemen is not a Saudi war, it's an American war. And we see what they've done in Afghanistan and how they're trying to force Lebanon into a failed state, and all the sanctions on Iran. We see only sanction and punishment that the American administration, one after the other, Republican or Democrats, are exerting exactly the same line of policy in this part of the world that is called West Asia. And they're not trying to construct anything. They're not trying to export technology or knowledge or self-governance. They're trying to submit people and to force them into their own hegemony. This is what many people in West Asia are rejecting, and this is why they're fighting the Americans, because they can see the example the Americans are setting. What your guest said rightly, they support corruption, they support corrupted government. We see that in Iraq, we see that now in Afghanistan, and they spend trillions of dollars only on supporting corruption and corrupted governments that are pro-U.S. only to say that we have some kind of control. Well, look, they just say we're going to withdraw and the whole country collapse again. What's the benefit on being in an area where it's going to fall immediately after the departure of the American, or just announcing a departure? This is a total failure, not only of the intelligence services, but also of the way any and every U.S. administration is trying to run the world and trying to occupy other countries. It is time for the U.S. to change its policy and allow the people of West Asia to decide its own fate.
Well, Madea, security seems to be the biggest goal of the Afghan people. Do you think that the Taliban can actually establish security in this country? Your assessment of that side of things?
Well, I have only seen examples of when they've gone into some of the villages and have been welcomed because they do bring security. We don't know what it will be like when they control the whole country. We don't know if security means very, very harsh implementation of an extremist kind of Sharia law, because there are different kinds of security. But we do see that in some of the areas where they're already governing, which has been actually quite a large swath of Afghanistan, especially in the rural areas, that there are many places where there is more security since the Taliban have arrived.
And Elijah, your perspective, possible scenarios for future Afghanistan under Taliban rule?
I think Taliban is going to be a new Taliban that is going to offer a different way to behave with the countries of the region and with its own population. The mere fact that they are entering the capital, Kabul, without fighting, and other cities without fighting, that tells us a lot. It tells us that the Taliban are not trying to kill as many people as they can, as they used to do in the past, but they are trying to offer another perspective of how Afghani can rule their own country. And this is why they are calling everybody to join the government. And this is the right thing, because Taliban on its own can never rule Afghanistan. Taliban needs all the other party and all the other ethnic group to join in one government and in one ruling. And by the fact that they are protecting the diplomatic missions, and Russia announced that it's not evacuating, unlike NATO, it means that the diplomatic mission feels safer with the presence of this Taliban that we saw how it's negotiating in Qatar and how he's talking to other countries. I've been in Iran. They're talking to different countries around the world, and they're not completely isolated as they used to be.
Okay, Madia, just 1 minute we have left. I mean, as Americans escape from Kabul now, it reminds us of the Saigon evacuation. How badly do you see the U.S.'s defeat there? And how does this affect the U.S. itself?
Well, it's a terrible blight on the United States after 20 years, but I am hoping that just like after the defeat in Vietnam, where there was what's called Vietnam Syndrome, the public aversion to getting involved in overseas conflicts, that we will now have an Afghanistan syndrome where the U.S. public says we do not want our government and our military invading and occupying other countries. Perhaps that's the only silver lining in this whole colossal failure.
Okay, and we can hope. Thank you so much, both of you, for being with us on this spotlight. Journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier out of Brussels, and co-founder of American Peace Movement Code Pink, Madia Benjamin, out of Washington, D.C. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Appreciate you being with us.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
According to a leaked draft of a report from the world's leading authority on climate science, global greenhouse gas emissions must peak in the next 4 years. Coal and gas-fired power plants must close in the next decade, and lifestyle and behavioral changes will be needed to avoid climate breakdown. We're prepared for you an article written jointly by Fiona Harvey and Giles Tremlett. The piece is titled, Leaked United Nations Report Says Greenhouse Gas Emissions Must Peak Within 4 Years. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. According to a leaked draft of a report from the world's leading authority on climate science, global greenhouse gas emissions must peak in the next 4 years, coal and gas-fired power plants must close in the next decade, and lifestyle and behavioral changes will be needed to avoid climate breakdown. Rich people in every country are overwhelmingly more responsible for global heating than the poor, with SUVs and meat-eating singled out for the blame. And a high carbon basis for future economic growth is also questioned. The leak is from the forthcoming third part of the landmark report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, the first part of which was published recently, warning of unprecedented changes to the climate, some of them irreversible. The document, called the Sixth Assessment Report, is divided into three parts. The physical science of climate change, the impacts and ways of reducing human influence on the climate. Part 3 is not scheduled to be released before next March, but a small group of scientists decided to leak the draft via the Spanish branch of Scientists' Rebellion, an offshoot of the Extinction Rebellion movement. It was first published by the journalist Juan Bordera in the Spanish online magazine CTXT. Juan Bordera told The Guardian that the leak reflected the concern of some of those involved in drawing up the document that their conclusions could be watered down before publication in 2022. Governments have the right to make changes to the summary for policymakers. The report finds the top 10% of greenhouse gas emitters globally, who are the wealthiest 10%, contribute between 36 and 45% of emissions, which is 10 times as much as the poorest 10% of countries, who are responsible for only about 3 to 5% of the greenhouse gas emissions. The summary says the consumption pattern of higher-income consumers are associated with large carbon footprints. Top emitters dominate emissions in key sectors. For example, the top 1% account for 50% of emissions from aviation. The report underlines the lifestyle changes that will be necessary, particularly in rich countries and among the wealthy globally. The report finds refraining from overheating or overcooling homes, walking and cycling, cutting air travel and using energy-consuming appliances less can all contribute significantly to the reductions in global greenhouse gas emissions that are needed. Eating patterns in many parts of the rich world will also need a change. A shift to diets with a higher share of plant-based protein in regions with excess consumption of calories and animal source food can lead to substantial reductions in emissions, while also providing health benefits. The report says plant-based diets can reduce emissions by up to 50% compared to the average emission-intensive Western diet. The report notes providing modern energy to all those who currently lack it, that is 800 million people have no access to electricity, would have a negligible effect on increasing greenhouse gas emissions. Cutting emissions in the next decade will be crucial to any hope of holding global heating within 1.5 degrees Celsius of pre-industrial levels, beyond which the impacts of climate breakdown will cause widespread devastation. The report warns weaker near-term action would place limiting warming to these levels out of reach, as it would entail assumptions about subsequent accelerated policy development and technology development and deployment, inconsistent with evidence and projections in the assessed literature. The report reaffirms the need to halve greenhouse gas emissions in the next decade to stay within 1.5 degrees Celsius and reach net zero emissions by 2050. Investment needed to shift the global economy to a low-carbon footing is also missing. According to the IPCC report, current investment falls below what is needed by a factor of 5, even to hold warming to the higher limit of 2 degrees Celsius. About $546 billion went towards cutting greenhouse gases and building resilience to the impacts of the climate crisis in 2018. The scientists say existing and planned infrastructure and investments, institutional inertia, and a social bias towards the status quo are leading to a risk of locking in future emissions that may be costly or difficult to abate. The report finds stranded assets will be a growing problem as coal-fired and gas power plants with working lives usually measured in decades will have to be decommissioned within 9 to 12 years of construction. The scientists echo the recent advice from the International Energy Agency, the IEA, that no new fossil fuel development can take place if the world is to stay within the 1.5 degrees Celsius of heating. The report says the combined economic impact of stranded fossil fuel resources and capital could amount to trillions of dollars. This risk could be reduced by shifting investment to low-carbon goods and low-carbon services. The report also finds technology to capture and store carbon dioxide has not progressed rapidly enough to play a major role yet, But technologies to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere would almost certainly be needed to hold heating to the 1.5 degrees Celsius limit. IPCC report notes there are some causes for optimism. Solar and wind energy and battery technology are now far cheaper thanks to policies that have encouraged their use. Cutting methane emissions would also be a major contributor to dampening temperature rises. The IPCC report says taking greater care of forests and land as important carbon sinks would also help to limit temperature rises, but must not be over-relied on. This comes as relatively low cost, but cannot compensate for slow emission reductions in other sectors. CTXT, the Spanish publication that leaked the draft IPCC report, said it showed that the global economy must be shifted rapidly away from a reliance on conventional GDP growth, but that the report underplays this. The Spanish publication CTXT wrote, "The essential radical change in an economic system whose perverse operation of accumulation and reproduction of capital in perpetuity has brought us to the current critical point is not clearly mentioned." The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, said it did not comment on leaks, and the purpose of the drafting process was to give the scientists time and peace to develop their assessment without external comment. Jonathan Lynn, head of the communications at the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, said, "Much of the text cited here, apparently from the first version of the summary for policymakers in the third working group, second order draft circulated to governments and expert reviewers in January, has already changed in the latest internal draft of the summary for policymakers now being reviewed by the authors of the report."
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.